With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Well, welcome everybody to today's show. This is Mark Kohler, yours truly, with my amazing co-host Matt Sorensen in the house. Matt.
Yes. Oh, so good to be here. Man, I love that rock and roll just, you know, playing on in the background there. Oh, I love coming into that.
Yeah, it is a good riff. We pay big bucks for it too, people. So
Yeah, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah, if you couldn't tell, that cost us a pretty penny. Well, this is our open forum show, so if some of you are like, "Man, these guys are cheap," their podcast sounds like crap. Well, it's because people, we are coming to you live through Blog Talk Radio, and it's not as crisp as a clean recording, and then it's uploaded to iTunes, and it's all, you know, edited out. This is live, uncut, slammed into iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify immediately after the show. Mm-hmm. And so keep it clean, people. Yeah.
Yeah.
No heckling on the show. You want to heckle? You can call me up. But
Right, yes. Send your email to mark@kkoslawyers.com. That's mark@kkoslawyers.com. If you have something good to say, you can send it to matt@kkoslawyers.com.
Yeah, good choice. Well, this is our show that we take live questions as well, so that's why it sounds a little different, and we do it every 3 weeks. We do an open forum call-in show. For those that are listening on their computer, for those that are listening on your computer, if you want to call in, let me give you the number. And some of you may already be listening on your phone. The call-in number is 646-668-8326. And you may want to make a note of that, folks, in your calendar, so next time you're on the Open Forum show, you'll just have the number ready to go. It's 646-668-8326. If you do dial in, turn down the volume on your computer, so there's a little delay, about 2 seconds, and it's annoying for you and for us. And then when you're on the line, people, if you have a question, just press the number 1. Then our illustrious staff will immediately come over and talk to you, which is me or Matt. And then we will
– overqualified.
Our overqualified intern, myself, will come over and get your name and where you're from, and then we'll bring you out live on the show for your question. Live callers have priority, so just keep it clean and have – in almost our history of 10 years, we only had one guy that got on here and started talking sex talk or something. He was just he wanted to
he's
stay
a racist
on the airwaves.
Too, I think. I mean, he was a piece of work. So, but I love this time, and you know, we sent out the request for questions this morning. Just a general reminder, and my email exploded with questions here. So, we love the questions. We're trying to get to the ones, particularly that we think can help the listeners, and we're going to try and reach back out to you, give you a point in the right direction at least on most of your questions, and we'll maybe divide it up between some of the new attorneys, which, you know, Mark, we got to announce, we got two new tax attorneys in our firm that joined over the last couple weeks. They're both experienced. They've been at other firms and working in the tax field in particular, and so this is an exciting time at KQS Lawyers. You may be hearing from one of them on one of your questions if we don't get to you.
Yeah, and since they're associates, we can tell them to do whatever. They can go get us drinks of water or a rock star out of
right.
the fridge. And if we tell them return some emails, you would think they would do that for their big paycheck. We had to steal them away from firms to come work with us. We are so excited. Let me tell you their names. First is Devin Munns, and that's D-E-V-E-N, Devin. Devin Munns, some of you would be calling to work with him. He's right here across the hall from me, so it's really handy for those that are like, I don't want to pay Mark's rates, but I'll talk to Devin, and then he can run across the hall and you know, get the extra poop
yeah.
if we need it. But, and the second attorney is Nolan Sorensen. No relation, though, Matt. Is that – Yeah, there's been
yeah,
rumors.
Yeah, I mean, we got to do our family genealogy compare notes. I'm sure there's some relation back there somewhere, but yeah, just odd coincidence, I guess.
Nolan. Yeah,
yeah,
Nolan.
I told him his name's already in
so,
the firm, and he's like, "Done. I'm hired. I want to work there. He already got my name on the door."
Yeah, I love it. Well, it's good. So anyway, we dispel, if you're new to our show, we are going to dispel with the weekly tax tip and legal tip. We're going to just try to burn through as many questions as we can. And again, if we don't mm-hmm. get to your question, you will get a personal email from either me, Matt, Devin, or Nolan. We'll try to point you in the right direction with either an article, a quick brief answer. Some of you folks, of course, you may want to set up a consult if we don't elaborate enough on the show for you, but we're grateful. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. We've got a lot to go through. So, Matt, why don't you kick us off? Why don't you
All
get
right.
in the first question? And I think we got a couple of
callers, hoping.
Too.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
Now, this one is awesome. I'm going to start off with a good one, okay? We're going to start the show right.
Uh-huh.
A repo question, okay? This is John Ooh. From Scottsdale. He's in the equipment finance business. He says, we went to repo some dental equipment from a dental office, but the landlord had taken all the equipment in the office and stored it, presumably because the dentist tenant was not paying their rent. Any reason why I cannot call them and pick up the few pieces we own that they stored? All right, now this is a great question, John. Yes, I presume in your equipment financing business that you're lending money secured against this equipment, and you'll have security agreements and possibly a UCC filed with the state that says and identifies the equipment that you loaned out money for. That's going to give you rights to go claim that property back. So, yes, go contact the landlord. And I would presume, I know you're in the business, John, that you can produce those documents, and the landlord's not going to have claim to them. What are they going to do with it anyways? So, but you'll have a claim even over the landlord, because the landlord might say, well, I'm owed rent. I could sue for this and I could take this collateral and really pay off what I'm owed. No, you're going to have your security agreement and a lien essentially against that. You'll have a better claim to that property. So I'd contact the landlord and go get your dental equipment. I don't know what you're going to do with it, but it's yours.
Yeah, you could go down to Puerto Rico and open a shop right away. And one other, you know, is funny. I literally had a repo man call me about 2 weeks ago and trying to track down one of my clients that was hiding from him with his car. And, of course, this guy had the, you know, harebrained idea that I might actually tell him where my client is. Yeah, sure, let me roll over for you. He's hiding behind, you know, the Starbucks on Main Street and 3rd South. Yeah, you know, like I'm going to roll my client. You know, this little thing called attorney-client privilege. So I told the guy to take a hike, but anyway. You know, whenever I hear the word Repo Man, too, I think of the 80s classic. Did you ever see Repo Man with Emilio Estevez back in the 80s, Matt?
No,
probably not, because
no.
You were about 5 years old back then. But.
I think of Dog the Bounty Hunter. I know he wasn't a repo man, but I'm sure he could be.
Close.
I think it's the same, you know, same stripe up guy,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. For any of you 80s rockers out there, you know, Repo Man was in the same class as Clockwork Orange or Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's just this terrible, it's not even B-movie, it's C-movie, but it's, I don't know, back in the 80s. Repo Man, look it up. Okay, so we've got a live caller. This is Peter out in New Jersey. So, Peter, I think a regular caller, too. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Hey,
all right,
Ben,
fire
what
away.
Do you
what you got
for us?
Yeah, so I'm in the business of buying and selling real estate, basically land. And I want to raise money for real estate investing. I know one way to go is do an offering and, private mm-hmm. placement. I know there's a lot of rules. However, I'm wondering if there's a simpler way to go. I don't want to break any securities laws, but if I'm just getting a loan from an individual with a promissory note, so they've got security in a property, are there any concerns that in any violation of securities laws, assuming mm-hmm. I'm doing the due diligence and the buying of the property and selling, and they're getting a rate of return, that could be anywhere, 8, mm-hmm. to, 12, 13%. Is that simple promissory note any concern for you, or is it, mm-hmm. we're in a different world where everything's a concern?
Ooh, good question. Mark, I guess you're all fire. I like this one.
You can go ahead. I didn't want to I had that wonderful rant about Repo Man. I didn't want to steal your thunder. It's probably
okay.
You're up.
All right,
you're
up. We try to share time here. We try to share time.
Yeah.
This is an excellent question, Peter. By the way, we do have a prior podcast about raising money and goes over our. Mark and I we invented this three. I don't know. I think it's called the triple threat to raising money. Okay, there's three ways you can raise money from people. They're either going to be a lender to you, which is what you're talking about. They could be a partner to you, where they're involved maybe in an LLC. They're the cash partner. You're the work partner. You got voting rights and stuff. Or they're going to be the investor, and that's the offering you were talking about, where it is expensive. It's more complicated. Now, the lender is definitely the easiest one. However, it's not just a promissory note. Yes, you want to have a promissory note. But most states will have a securities law exemption that says it's not a security if you raise money for real estate so long as there is a promissory note that is fully secured in first position against the property. So if you can show, hey, I got a promissory note, it's secured in first position and it's fully secured based on the equity of the property, almost every state I've ever looked at has an exemption for securities law for that, so that will never be a security. We're really concerned about unsecured notes, though, in particular. Those can be securities. Regulators, in particular, are more aggressive in pursuing those if there's complaints or they see you raising money in unsecured notes. So stick to it secured, preferably in first position, fully secured against the property. If you do, then you don't have to stress about securities laws.
That's great.
And never to be outdone, Peter, let me chime in a couple thoughts. There's pros and cons to each option. Some people don't want to just be a lender. They want to be a partner. But then yesterday I had to deal with a client that was given a promissory note with an equity interest. Well, that's just a partnership, and they're going to be personally liable, and they were shocked to know that. I thought it was just a note. No, if you're going to get a piece of the profit on the back end, that's a partnership. That's not a note. And a lawyer is going to come after you with the deeper pockets. So anyway, there's a lot to this, and there's going to be different pros and cons of each option. I looked it up. The show number is Refresh Your Wealth 282, and it was just only a month ago that we recorded the most recent update. There's also episode 248 that's about 6 months old. Both of those shows I would highly recommend. For almost an hour, we go through those options in detail. And that's 282 and 248. So on iTunes, you'll be able to find them quickly by looking at the show number.
Terrific.
Sound
good,
Peter?
And
feeling it?
I was just going to say, listening to your shows, I mean, you guys provide just great content and just extremely, extremely helpful information. So just wanted to say thanks.
Oh.
And then,
thank you.
And my follow-up question, okay, and appreciate the info on that first question. The follow-up is, if I've got an LLC and I've got several performing properties, rather than one note per property, can I sell an interest in the LLC? Or something else again, not to
Peter. You were
yeah.
Peter. You were doing so good. You were doing so good. not as easy, because now what you're selling is an interest in an LLC. Are they going to be a partner with you? Are they going to have voting rights? Now, you could look at that. We could say, all right, is this going to just be a small partnership arrangement, essentially, where someone's buying into your LLC that owns real estate? If it's maybe one or two people or a small group of people, it's a partnership. They're really involved in the business. They got voting rights with you. You could get away with a partnership, possibly. I mean, we want to walk through some other factors. But an existing LLC with existing assets, selling out interests, it's got to only be partnership to get around securities laws. Otherwise, if you're not going to let them have voting rights and be involved, you're going to have to go the offering or fund route.
Yeah, right. But great questions, Peter. Thanks for joining us. Seriously. Yeah.
Thank you.
No, we appreciate that. And I'm glad we didn't cut you off before you told us how great we were. That would have been a real travesty. So that's good. All right. Well, thanks, Peter. Okay, so let's hit a couple email questions, and then we're going to go back to the phones. We have a couple callers. This is Julie out in Louisiana. She's an accountant, which we love to have professionals. It's always an honor to have a fellow professional on the show. She said, Mark, can you please give me advice on how to do taxes when an S corporation business owning multiple LLC businesses and some DBAs, running the books, bringing it all together? Are all the income and expenses combined in the end in an 1120S tax return? Okay, now if some of you that sounded like garbly goop, let me rephrase Julie's question. For all of you out there that have an S corporation, as in small, as in Sam, we love S corporations for small business owners that are creating operational income. Now, you might have several sources. You might be a handyman. You might be doing a fix and flip and rehab. You might be a realtor. You might be doing drywall. You might be doing hair and nails. You might have an internet business. You can have four or five sources of income coming into one S corp, and that's okay. Now, there's some liability concerns. You might want some separation if one of them was to really grow and expand and had a lot of a liability concern. But from a tax perspective, people, try to run them all through the same S corp. Now, Julie, what we love is QuickBooks. We'd lean on QuickBooks Pro. We would do the classification or classes for each source of income. Matt, we're getting a little feedback on your phone, by the way. Sorry. There's some classes that will help divide that up. And so you can look at the different income coming through from the different locations. And then you can, at the end of the day, it all, yes, comes together into your one S-Corp tax return. For lay people out there, this is beautiful. You have one S-Corp. You've got income from multiple sources. It all comes into one 1120S tax return, and you can do one payroll for yourself. But to determine how your businesses are doing successfully or not, that's where you use QuickBooks and classes or sub-accounts. Different accountants, you know, different strokes for different folks. But, Julie, we like the classes. That's where we lean. So, Matt, do you have a question you want to lean on or make a comment
there? I do.
Do you have anything?
Nope. Okay. I'm going to leave that one as is. It was just perfect. Why touch it? So this is from Charles. Now, this is from a prior week show, and he was, like, anxious to get this one through. We promised we'd get to his question. It's a good question. He says, I've been doing some private money lending to local real estate investors lately. So far, all of the loans have been done in my personal name, where he's the lender. I'm wondering if there's any benefit to lending through an LLC. What liabilities could a small private lender face? All right, this is a good question. And it really boils down to whether to use an LLC as simply liability, Charles. From a tax perspective, the small private lending, as long as you're not doing a lot of loans where you're kind of looking like a bank, that's just going to be interesting coming points. I wouldn't stress too much about using an S-Corp or other entity. Now, in terms of using an LLC, though, it might make sense, as we talk about often on the show, using an LLC for liability protection. The LLC is a limited liability company. We like to use that to protect you personally from risks of the business, risks of these loans, so to speak. I really think it's a cost-benefit thing to really look at. What's the cost of the LLC? It's about $800 in our office to set up an LLC. You probably don't need a tax return to this because it'll be single member and flow down to you personally anyways on your tax return, so you likely don't need a LLC tax return like a partnership return or anything. So if it's worth $800 for the liabilities you may face, then I'd set it up. Now, I don't know what liabilities you face. Frankly, it depends on the type of deals you're lending on. Are these second position notes? Are there other lenders in first position? Are they rehab projects where there could be contractor claims and other things? What's the type of
borrowers you're lending money to? Do you know them well? Do they have litigation problems where you could get sucked in? Those are the things I'd consider to determine whether you would benefit from having an LLC.
Man, I went away to talk to our next caller, and I came back, and it sounded like a really boring answer there. Could you spruce it up a
little?
It wasn't, actually.
You just missed the good part.
Okay. I missed the good part. Okay. All right. All right. Well, we've got a caller now live. This is Steve from Weberville, North Carolina, up in the mountains. Pretty excited about it. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Is it Weberville or Weberville?
It's Weberville. We're close to Asheville.
Okay, cool.
I have a feeling that most of those towns in North Carolina end in Ville. You know,
there's a lot of them. That's Asheville. Exactly right. Yep. Well, my question drills down a little bit more on what you had from Julie, the accountant, actually. I had a very similar question, but Mark wondered if you could expand a little bit about setting up the one S-Corp and maybe having multiple entities, different lines of business that feed into that. Can each of those be a different LLC, or should they be? If you're not worried about liability, partitioning the liability between those different lines of businesses?
Well, good question. The first approach Matt and I take is that if you've got separate sources of income, and you can just – maybe you're doing some stuff online, so maybe you reserve several URL or website addresses, maybe several DBAs, and there's not a lot of liability exposure. Our first goal would be to keep it simple, stupid. You know, the KISS principle. We love that. Let's keep it simple. We don't need extra LLCs. We're good. But the two categories, the two triggering events where an LLC makes sense as a subsidiary is if Matt calls me up and goes, Mark, I got this great idea. I want to set up a paintball course. We're going to go out and just shoot each other with paintballs, get our aggression out, and it's ordinary income. So we definitely want an LLC.
I love the example here. Okay.
Yeah, I just pulled that off the top of my head. But we've got two triggering events. First, I've got a partnership. So if I'm ever going to have a partner, my S-Corp would partner with someone else, and we'd set up an LLC. And then number two, if you have liability, and a paintball shop or a paintball course would be very much of a concern from a liability standpoint. So I've got two reasons to have an LLC to kind of separate my other income from that little operation and that little harebrained scheme. But if possible, again, keep it all in the S-Corp without extra LLCs. But if there's liability or partners, I think that's when it triggers an LLC in our world.
All right, great. So if you you could just really have it as a sole proprietorship or one LLC, it sounds like, that does the S election.
Okay, now that's almost a step back in a sense, if I could say, Steve, where that's more baseline. The first level, I mean, I just assumed you had an S corp and you were debating subsidiaries. Now, if you're saying, well, my main company is going to be an LLC taxed as an S corp, well, that's cool. That sounds good. So you can either start with an LLC, make an S election. Maybe you already have an LLC. It's time for an S election, or you just come right out of the gate with an Inc. And that's where, you know, when we, in a consult with your personal situation, we can say, well, here's the best way to go and that sort of thing. But sounds like you're on the right track.
Sure. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, it's an honor having you on the show. Thanks for calling in. We really appreciate it. Keep listening, please. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, Matt, okay, back into the emails. I've got one from Scott.
Okay, I'm ready. Okay.
Now, it is a tax question. I'm going to probably end up talking, so I've already been talking quite a bit. Do you have an IRA question you want to throw out?
I got a crypto question, actually. So,
ooh, crypto.
This is from Ben.
Ooh, let's go down crypto.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so this is Ben asking, what would be the ideal way to set up a business which does cryptocurrency mining without having to pay self-employment tax or UBIT if an IRA LLC? In other words, how would one take advantage of the new reduced business tax rates and reduced personal rates on crypto mining to an absolute minimum? Okay, Ben, so this is an important question. I first want to describe cryptocurrency mining so we're all on the same page. So those of you listening, you know, you've heard of cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and, you know, all the Bitcoin millionaires and billionaires out there. And now what a lot of people are doing in the cryptocurrency space is simply investing, not mining. These are two different things. Cryptocurrency investing would simply be buying, let's say, Bitcoin or Ethereum or Litecoin or whatever you're buying. Buying it at $1,000 a coin and hoping it goes up to $2,000 a coin and selling it for a profit, just like you would buy U.S. currency and hope that it goes up in value, or some type of foreign currency. So now that investing is going to be treated as capital gain income for retirement accounts or for you personally. So that's not as complicated. That's actually better tax treatment. That's not what Ben's asking about. I just want to make that clear because most people are doing cryptocurrency investing. What Ben's asking about is cryptocurrency mining. What cryptocurrency
mining is, and we got to be clear. What Ben's going to do is he's going to put on a little hard hat, grab a pick and a shovel, and he's going to go into Silicon Valley. And I think he's going to just start, you know, pounding on buildings or cars and looking for this coin. Is that how it works, Matt?
That's essentially how it works. And you kind of just walk around on your phone. There's an app for it. And, you know, you just go try and find the treasure. So, what it is, cryptocurrency exists on what's called a blockchain technology. And blockchain is simply a ledger. It's a way to track who owns what piece of cryptocurrency. But in order to validate when stuff transfers, like I use cryptocurrency to buy something or I exchange it with someone, it requires mining. There's got to be people through servers. There's computer servers that are set up. There's a lot of hardware involved in this that are essentially verifying transactions and keeping the blockchain network and the ledger, so to speak, of the cryptocurrency intact. And it's verified. There's multiple parties. It's independent. It's called cryptocurrency mining. You typically get paid from the type of crypto you're mining as a fee. There's some cool things going on there. But the important part for Ben's question and the tax part is that is ordinary income. So yes, Ben, unfortunately, that's ordinary income you typically have to pay self-employment tax on if you're doing this personally. If your IRA is doing it, it means UBIT income. So on the personal side, we're going to say do an S-Corp. Any type of business, for the most part, that's ordinary income in nature, which means you're going to pay self-employment tax, you're going to have to pay to Medicare and Social Security on top of your regular income. We like to use an S-corporation. We've got a lot on our websites about the S-corporation strategy and why in that situation. On the IRA side, you could do what's called a blocker corporation. I don't want to bore everyone to death, but essentially you can get the new corporate tax rate of 21% as opposed to the UBIT rate of 39%. We do a blocker corporation owned by the IRA, and that would be a good option for you there. Man, if you don't like cryptocurrency, UBIT tax,
we may have just lost several listeners.
That was a doozy.
Yeah, it's a good one. Hey, and I want to say, I was actually listening to – I was going to jump over to the other line for our next caller, and I was listening because, guys, I'm not kidding. Every time Matt talks about crypto, I learn something, and it's pretty cool. Okay, well, we've got a live caller. We're going to take this one real quick. This is Scotty in – Irvine, California. Scotty, welcome to the show. What do you got for us?
Well, I got two questions for you, two quick ones. One, if somebody receives money from like a GoFundMe, do they get like a 1099 and are responsible for taxes on that?
Ooh, good question.
And then the other one.
Well, okay, go ahead. Yeah, let's get them out in there. We'll just take them off the line. Yeah, you go for it. Okay, number two.
And then the second one is reference like my self-directed LLC. What taxes are due and when?
Okay. Well, I can definitely field number one, and I know Matt, the amazing, the greatest showman, you know, no friend, you know, for those out there that love the show. Matt will not sing and dance, but we'll let Matt field number two. Okay. So on question one, any of you out there, now this is good for anybody that might invest in something. Now we're not talking about partnering in an LLC where you may do a GoFundMe or you might put some money into a project. You might buy stock or something. A GoFundMe is a little unique. The reason why is because sometimes with a GoFundMe, you're going to put money in and you might get something back. Like I helped a client that was doing a GoFundMe, and I put in $50 or $100, and they sent me a stocking cap and a little gift, and I thought, oh, that's cool, and then we'll see what happens, right? There's different types of GoFundMes. There's those where you just want to help someone out and you get a little gift. There's those where almost like a donation where you get nothing in return. And then there's those GoFundMes where you get a piece of the action if the project takes off. Now, if the project does not happen or for whatever reason and you lose your money, just as if you were to invest in anything else, you get to take a write-off for that. It would go on a Schedule D. A Schedule D is on David on your 1040. You'd talk to your accountant about it, let him know when you invested and when it became worthless. You got to have this date, you know, in time where it kind of just died. And so you may not get a 1099. You might get a 1099. Don't worry about the 1099. If you put money in and you've determined it's worthless, turn it into your accountant and get a freaking write-off. But your accountant should ask you about this. If it is a GoFundMe, did you receive a gift in return? Was it truly an investment where you had a stake in future profit? You might want to have your ducks in a row regarding the project that you engaged in. And different GoFundMes have different procedures. So. Great question. Woo, that's a hard one. I hope I answered it. If not, you'd please send me an email, Scotty. Matt, an IRA LLC. I'm an IRA owner,
right,
and I'm going to have an LLC, and I'm going to go invest. What do I need to worry about reporting-wise?
Well, the good news is if you go to SDRAhandbook.com, I wrote an article called Tax Reporting Deadlines for Your Self-Directed IRA, where I cover most of this stuff. So if you've a self-directed investor or you have an IRA LLC, check that out. It depends on the LLC. There's two things here. When does my IRA need to file something? When does my LLC need to file something? Your IRA only needs to file something if you run into UBIT or UDFI tax. When you're self-directing an IRA, you should know what that is. It's Chapter 15 in my book if you don't, or my website's got details. So that's for your IRA. The LLC, though, if the LLC is 100% owned by your IRA, it's considered single member or disregarded for tax purposes, which means there's no federal tax return required for the LLC. Now, if you have a partnership LLC, maybe it's multiple IRAs or some IRAs and individuals, that LLC will need to file a partnership tax return. There's no tax due on that, but it's an actual partnership return that declares the total profit and says what each partner got is their share of profit or loss. The last thing I would just note is some states will still have a filing that you need to file and pay a fee, California being one. If you have a California LLC, even if it's a single member, you still have a franchise tax board filing and a payment of $800 that you got to send to the state of California. But most states, you're not going to have that. Most states, you just pay your annual fee to keep the LLC active, and there's no tax return if the LLC is single member owned 100% by one IRA.
Love it. Great answers. And I recommend everyone just get to Matt's article. I'll repeat it slowly. www.sdira, as in self-directed IRA, so sdirahandbook.com. And he's got a ton of resources on the site, and the book is simple and affordable. You'll read it by the bedstand for nights, and it'll drive your partner crazy. So check it out. Now, I need to say for a number of people that have called in a little later than the initial few moments of the show, if you've called in and you have a live question, press the number 1. We'll jump off and get your name and where you're from, and we'll have you out on the show. Until then, let's jump over to an email question. If you've joined us late, if we don't get to your email question or on a live call, please be patient. We'll email us and we'll have one of the attorneys give you a quick reply with maybe an article or a video to watch and try to point you in the right direction. Okay, this question is from Scott. He says, my wife is a real estate professional. Ooh. This is good for a lot of our listeners. A real estate professional, how can she deduct her travel and meals expense looking at other potential investment properties? Where does one put these deductions on one's 1040 as well? So it's kind of a two-part question. Let's start with real estate professional, though. For anybody out there that's maybe new to that term, real estate professional doesn't mean you're buying rentals. It means that you or your spouse – because if one of you qualifies, you both qualify, which is nice. But if you or your spouse really do real estate full-time, you might be a licensed realtor or a contractor, or maybe you just manage a bunch of rentals of your own, or you go out and do rehabs and fix and flips. But arguably, you don't have a day job, no W-2, and you just kind of do real estate. And it's typically around 750 hours a year, about 13 hours a week. Most of you realtors out there do that by Monday night. So that's why you would be a real estate professional. Now, there's tax benefits to that because you get flow-through loss write-offs where other people don't. And but it's really a business. So what Scott says is, my wife's a real estate professional, and she's out looking at investment properties. Cool. How does she deduct her travel and meals? Well, first of all, Scott, keep in mind her auto deductions are going to be separate from travel. So auto is 90% of our clients do mileage. Mileage is a great write-off. I think we've got another ancillary question here we might field quickly. Justin had a question about mileage log, and he asked if I do a 179 deduction and use actual expenses instead of the mileage rate, do I still keep a mileage log? And the answer is yes. And now, folks, if you can just estimate your mileage, that generally does the trick. The IRS would want you to produce a detailed mileage log. This is where having an app, there's phone apps to do this, makes your life easy. But whether you're Justin that's doing actual, or in this situation where Scott's wife might be a real estate professional doing just standard mileage, everybody should kind of be able to estimate their mileage because you have percentage of my car, business versus personal, even if you are doing actual. So anyway, little side note there to Justin's question. But anyway, so keep in mind, Scott, that mileage and auto is different from travel. Travel is going to be airfare, rental cars, Uber, a hotel, and then meals are still deductible. Up to 50% when you're traveling. Now, Scott, if your wife is just driving around town, she's not going to be able to write off meals. It has to be outside of a normal commute. So if maybe Scotty, who lives in Irvine on our last call, if his wife or himself takes off and goes to L.A., well, that's like going to a foreign country. If you're from Southern California, that was a joke. But anyway, you've got to drive at least 2 hours or 3 hours in traffic, and it's going to be a pain in the rear. So you deserve an In-N-Out burger once you get to L.A., and you can write it off. But if you're just buzzing around Irvine, you can't write off your meals, people. It has to be outside of a normal commute. And then he says, where do you put all this on a 1040? Well, Scott, if your wife is a real estate professional, it could be a Schedule E for the rentals. If that's all she's doing is rentals, then all of these expenses are going to be on a Schedule E as an echo. Or if she really is getting some commissions and flipping property, you might have a Schedule C as in Charlie, and that's where she would write them off. And you got to be careful if you got self-employment tax. You want to be thinking LLC and an S-Corp scenario. So talk to us there if you're making 30 grand or more doing this and it's not rentals. So, Scott, lots there. I hope that helped answer your question. Matt, woo!
Man, you made it out alive there. Jeez.
Yeah, and I knocked out two questions, baby. Two questions in one call, man.
Oh, good. All right, good job. If you didn't know, Mark Kohler bills by the hour. So,
there was a lot there. There was a lot there.
Usually, I'm the guilty party on that. Okay, well, I've got a question here. I've actually got two on a similar topic. So I'm gonna, two birds with one stone thing here. This is from Michael. Okay. He says, I have an LLC that is owned by four 401k accounts and one IRA. Okay, love it. Great little partnership structure there. Combine those accounts into one LLC, probably to buy a property or particular asset. He says, my question is, if it owns income real estate, do I need to depreciate it on my taxes? Now, I want to make a couple points here that I think is important because there's some related questions I've got here too on the topic. Now, if you have your retirement accounts that own an LLC and there's no debt involved, it's just the retirement accounts cash, we don't care about depreciation. Doesn't matter. It's not going to help you. Your retirement account's not paying tax on this income. Why worry about depreciation? So, no, you don't need to worry about depreciation. Now, the second part that's important to note here is he says, do I need to depreciate it on my taxes? Now, I presume you mean the retirement account's taxes because, remember, your retirement accounts own the LLC. The LLC owns the property. Everything's flowing down to your retirement accounts, not to you personally. So if there was depreciation that would be claimed or if there was taxes for these investments, they would be done by your retirement account, and your retirement account would file a tax return. So
none of these assets that your retirement account owns are reported on your personal return at all. But in your situation, don't stress. Don't need to worry about reporting depreciation. The retirement accounts don't pay taxes on the income, so who cares about those expenses? Again, unless you're in a leveraged debt situation like UDFI. Now, the other question I had, and this is someone that on the related vein here said, can I take the depreciation expense for my self-directed IRA on my personal return? No. So I know it sounds like it's tax time right now and people are doing their tax returns and they're realizing, great, I don't pay taxes on the income my IRA made, but what about my depreciation? Well, sorry, folks, that depreciation expense, you don't have to pay tax on the income, but you don't get the expense either. And you can't convert it over and claim it on your personal return. You got to take the good with the bad.
All right. Yep, I love it. Great, aptly handled, Matt. Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to go back to the phones. We've got Mike in Hawaii. And Mike, I want to let you know I've got my Hawaii playlist up. I've been listening to it all morning on Spotify, and I've got green queued up for the next song. So just so you know, I'm feeling the love. So, Mike, what do you got for us?
Perfect. I'll have to I'll have to check out Green and see what they're all about.
Yeah. Oh, come on! It's that I might be. Yes, I'm an idiot. You know, I might be. It's The Green. By the way, for anybody out there, it's called The Green. Check it out. All right. Anyway, Mike, what do you got?
I've got two questions, Mark. My first question is, I pay rent at the home that I live in. And I am renting out the lower level of my home. Can I deduct expenses on that? And my second question is, historically, I've grossed about, as an independent 1099 contractor, I've grossed about $90,000 over the last 5 years or so. In 17, I grossed a little over $200,000. And with the new tax laws, is there any way that I can roll that income into my existing S corporation? I've run basically nothing through that S corporation historically, but I plan to soon. So,
and on the second part of that, you said this income you're earning, is that W-2 wages, this other quote-unquote day
job,
if you will?
1099 independent contractor, paid as an individual, not through my corporation. And so can I kind of backroll that into my existing S-Corp?
Yes. So let's talk, and I'll take this question off the line. Two big questions. And so thank you, Mike. And I don't want to get too verbose like I did on the last one. Let me say this now, Mike. We might need a quick call for 20 or 30 minutes to kind of fine-tune some of those issues. Let me say first the subletting. This is a good one, folks, out there. We have a number of clients calling us that are doing kind of a VRBO, Airbnb subleasing strategy. So what they'll do is they'll go out and find a house, rent it for a year, and then turn around and do a VRBO. Now, let's say you got a home that you could rent for $1,500 a month, but then you get VRBO rates that might be $200 a night. And you rent it 10 nights out of the month, you brought in $2,000 in rent, but you're only paying $1,500, you made money. So we have clients doing that all over the country. Now there's risk, because if you don't get your VRBO rents, you got to come out of pocket on that thing. Now in this situation, Mike says, well, I'm already living here. I'm just renting out the basement. So Mike, theoretically, I don't know if the math would work out or if it would be worth it, but the technical procedure would be you get a deduction for the portion of rent you're paying, because this is a business now, and you're paying rent to rent the basement, and then you're turnarounding and subletting it. So theoretically, you're making money on that process, or you wouldn't be doing it. So let's say the basement is worth $300 a month in rent, but you're renting it to someone else for $500 a month. That means you're making $200 net. Well, once you start there, you've got a business, and you get to write off your rent proportionally, but you have to claim theirs that they're paying you, and then you want to run the numbers and go, okay, what else is going on? Are there utility bills? And you know, I can't depreciate the place because I don't own it, I just am renting. So you'd really run the numbers and see if it's worth claiming this or playing the game, and if you had a net loss. I don't know it. So I would probably say it's not worth your time in general, but you'd want to look at it. Now, for those out there doing VRBO projects, they're looking at making – it's a business. Obviously, it's not part of their home. More involved. Second part, I'm just going to summarize this quickly. If any of you are out there getting a 1099 personally for subcontracting in some way, shape, or form, and you do have an S corporation, we got to funnel it through there. And that's where we can do what's called nominee income, and we can move that income into your S corporation, even if the 1099 is coming to you personally. But if, Mike, you're talking about last year, 2017, you haven't done a payroll in your S corp, it may be too late. Some accountants, there are some backdoor strategies to kind of jam it in there that we might take you through. There's a little bit of risk, but it could be a big payoff. If you're willing to say, you know, roll the dice with the IRS a little bit, we might be able to backdoor that money even in for last year. But you want to be legit and honest with the IRS. And it's not that you wouldn't be able to do it. It's just would the IRS send you a letter and do kind of a line item audit and go, what are you doing here? So, but anyway, the point is, everybody, in 2018, if you're making money and getting a 1099, and it's coming to you personally, but you do have an S corp, yeah, we want to run it through there. Let's save some taxes. Lots of options there. Matt,
yes.
We field our next live caller. We've got several live callers. We may not even be able to get to our live callers. I'm going to do my best, take them in order of when they arrived on the show. Matt, do you have an email question you want to field in the meantime?
Yes, this is from Cannon. Cannon wrote in and says, I use a lot of day laborers, and often they don't want to give Social Security number. Is it true that as long as I have them sign a receipt for work / payment, I can still write off a certain amount per person?
Ooh, I want to stay right.
Okay.
This is good.
Some dangerous territory here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the first thing to note, if you're paying them over $600 per person, you're going to need their social because you're going to need to send them a 1099 to be able to expense it. That's the first point I want to make. Now, if you're picking laborers up for just one day, you may not be paying them $600. I mean, I don't know. So it's possible you could be, you know, having a signed receipt. If you're paying them cash, like I know happens, make sure you're definitely having them sign a receipt for that. And if it's over $600, you are going to need their social. We'll need to 1099 them. But one thing I will say on this is you need to be very careful. You know, a large business that's in the business of maybe construction or something or manufacturing where there may be day laborers, they're not going to deal with this because this is risky. There's a lot of problems that can arise. We got workers' comp issues. What if they get injured while they're on the job and working? They're going to sue you. You're going to have personal liability possibly unless you're operating through a company. Even if you have a company, they may try and get it through it because you were kind of skirting the laws here with the day laborers. You just need to be careful on that. They're not going to be carrying insurance. I mean, so we've just seen some problems with this over the years with clients, so tread lightly, not just from a tax standpoint, but also just from a liability standpoint.
Yeah, I think this is a big, big issue, and I've written articles on this too, subcontractors versus employees. Please read those. Bottom line, if you're going to be legit and build a business, stay away from cash payment sub-laborers, day laborers. It's not worth the risk. It just really isn't. Okay, we've got Bill in Arlington, Texas. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much. I love all the stuff y'all do. How much can I pay my kids this year through my S corp?
Ooh, I like it.
Ooh.
Paying kids through an S corp, I like it. Okay, well this is a crazy one. This year, the answer is up to $12,000 because the standard deduction for individuals got raised to $12,000. Wow. Now, that can be a dangerous thing. Before, last year, it was in the 6,000 range. And, you know, you never were going to pay your teenager more than $6,000. That's essentially $500 a month for cleaning the office and helping in the office and run errands and all that. But with the doubling of the standard deduction, it really does open the door. Now, let's back up and let's say this. You can pay your kids whatever you want. But when you pay them below the standard deduction, they don't even have to file a tax return. And Bill, be careful. You would never pay your kids directly out of an S-Corp because then you'd have to W-2 or 1099 them. We like to use the little sole proprietorship support company to your S-Corp, and that's where we pay the kids. It's a well-established law. It's a great fit. I've got this in my book, in Tax and Legal Playbook, on paying family members. Also, if your accountant gives you any heartache, call us and we can help you walk you through that. But there's a but the bottom line is you could pay them up to $12,000. So, Bill, be careful and make sure it's justifiable labor. I usually start kids out at 5 or 6 years old for $100 a month, helping in the office clean and do things. And then it kind of goes up from there. Maybe a 12-year-old is getting $3,000 a year working in the summers, and teenagers get $4,000 or $5,000. Maybe a 16 or 17-year-old might get $7,000 or $8,000, but you better be able to show that they worked in the business. But, Bill, great question. We're going to keep moving here and read up on that. And I've got some videos on YouTube, right? Just Google Mark Kohler paying kids. Okay, Matt, go ahead.
Don't pay them out of the S-Corp. Make sure you're doing the family management company. It's kind of a two-step process. If you got an S-Corp, don't pay them directly out of the S-Corp. All right. I got a lot of IRA questions here, so I'm going to at least field one.
Get one more.
It's kind of an easy one. This is from Frank. Frank says, can my IRA LLC borrow money from my wife's IRA LLC? Is this a prohibited transaction? Sorry, Frank, but this is prohibited. Your IRA is prohibited to your wife's IRA, so you cannot transact between, lend or borrow between your retirement accounts. It's going to be prohibited, and the bummer is if you did it, it's prohibited for both accounts. You'd lose both accounts, so stay away from that. All right, got another question here. I'm just going to keep firing away. This is another
Matt,
one
I'm good.
On IRAs.
Okay.
You ready? You got
another IRA
someone?
One then. Well, I got someone.
Okay.
Let's do it because we got live callers stacked up here. And it's such an honor. I just want to tell everybody around the country, man, we love you. This is like awesome. And I'm so grateful that people are taking an interest in tax and legal. It makes me feel like I'm not a complete nerd. Okay, this is
– You are. You're just not alone.
I'm just not – That's a good point. I am a nerd. I'm just not alone. No offense for those out there. Okay, this is Serge in LA. I'm not calling you a nerd, Serge. I'm just saying, you know, you've got a tax and legal.
I most definitely am. So thank you for the shout out anyway. And gentlemen, thank you much. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have two connected questions regarding professional corporations in restrictive states like California. So my situation is I'm a medical doctor, I'm a physician, so one of the fields typically limited to a professional corporation, and I both have W-2 income from a full-time regular clinical day job, and I've just started getting income on the side from a new consulting service line I've put together. Now, the consulting business has really started to take off unexpectedly, and given concerns regarding both liability and tax management, of course, I'm interested in creating an entity specifically for the consulting branch. The place where I've got my main question is, am I obligated to create a professional corporation in California as opposed to a different entity type if the consulting work I'm going to do through this entity is not in a service that would legally require me to have a California license? So in my case, for example, I help a lot of companies do medical marketing, business strategy, or I'm on medical advisory boards. But technically speaking, I don't need a California medical license to do any of those. On the other hand, these companies really wouldn't be hiring me in the first place had it not been for my subspecialty ex-professional reputation. So someone could argue, well, it really is a professional service and you really need to be creating a professional corporation.
Okay, you bet. And you said it's part two, and then I'll field this off the line, or is that it? We're good.
And part two, frankly, would be if the answer is yes, and you think this really should be a professional corporation, then you know I've watched some of your fantastic videos online, and it sounds like really the thing to do would be create a professional corporation, most likely have it elect a S-Corp taxation scheme. But then the issue is with the new tax law, there's this funny 20% QBI deduction, which phases out at around $150,000 for singles who are in professional services. And my question there would be, does that 20% phase out consider all income, meaning all of my W-2s combined with any dividends I get, or is it just income that's being funneled through the S-Corp?
Ooh, good questions. Okay, I'm going to take that off the line. And Serge, thank you for calling. And I think you'll enjoy this. And we ought to have a call for a few minutes to wrap up any loose ends if I don't hit it all. And thank you so much.
Definitely.
Thank you so much. Okay, so here's the first point, the professional corp. You're not hurting yourself by doing a PC. And that, in fact, I think you increase your reputation. You can run multiple sources of income through it. And even if you're not required to do the PC, it's probably going to make you look better. I mean, why not hang your professional hat on it and be a PC? If you go the route
in California,
you might even restrict yourself.
I was saying California, they call it a medical corporation even. You know, they've even gone on the PC and they've distinguished PCs. You got dental corporations, medical corporations. So it even gets a little more dicey there. But sorry, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, no. And that's a great comment. And every state's a little different. And these, they're called DOPLs or Department of Professional Licensing. They can be an animal. And so, frankly, I would also say this, Serge, when you're going through the process, just tell them what they want to hear and get the freaking thing approved and get done. And then the real benefits start to play out with the IRS. And so I would say in general, go the PC route. That way you can do anything you want in there, plus you'll look good. If you go the Inc. route and someone does want to pay you for some actual medical services, which is going to happen, you know it's going to happen, and then you're going to be stuck. You're not a PC maybe, and they freak out, and you're back to square one. So I just go the PC route and stick with it. Number two, you bring up a great question. This is good for everybody out there, is that this new pass-through deduction of 20% phases out if you're in a personal service type business, medical, legal, engineering, accounting, realtors, actors, athletes, actresses, actors and actresses, you know, after the, you know, Oscars, I'm a little more aware. So Serge here is facing this phase out, which sucks. And so here's the problem, Serge. It's your basic AGI that they're looking at right now. So if you have an AGI, and this is the scary part, even if your spouse had a totally separate job and you're filing jointly and you had, you know, a higher level of AGI where you start phasing out at 315. But the point is, whether it's income from the actual professional service or an unrelated W-2, if your AGI is over those thresholds, you start phasing out and you don't get the 20% pass-through, even on income where you would deserve it. Now, we are waiting for IRS regulations later this year. You know, please keep following my newsletter and the vids and the articles, and we'll bring it all together. But as we learn more, but be careful there. Okay, I've got to say this. Matt, I'm going to let you field the last question in our last couple minutes. I want to squeeze one more in, so you choose wisely, my friend. And those that called in and I wasn't able to get to you, please just email me or Matt, and I'll forward it to Matt anyway so he can reply via email. So that way we try to get your question answered. That was a joke, Matt. That was for you. Okay, go ahead, Matt. What do you got for
right
us?
Over.
This last
I was reading Patrick's question. All right, Patrick says, love the show. Thank you, Patrick. I'm a solo tech consultant and a digital nomad. He says, I'm not a resident of any U.S. state. Which state would you recommend incorporating in, though? And meaning any state in the federal level. Well, I would probably recommend a state where you have some connection. Or I would go to a state like Wyoming, Arizona, Delaware. There's some states where you might want to look at that have a much easier tax and filing. So let me just say this. What you want to consider is, is there a state tax connection I'm going to have in that state? We want to try and find a state where it has no state income tax, which could be like a Wyoming or a Texas or a Delaware. You also want to look at what are the annual fees for this entity. What you want to avoid states that have high fees, like Nevada. Nevada may have no state income tax, but they have a very high fee. Now, you could go to – I'd probably say Wyoming be my default right now without knowing much more about you. And I want to say this for everybody else. This is only for someone that really does not live in the U.S. but has some business in the U.S. on a digital basis, looks like a web-based – this could be a good fit for you. Everyone else, we're going to typically go where the state where you're residing or typically doing business out of.
Yep. And I want to say this because I have a note on my wall, the big non-income tax states. So I want to my amazing partner will correct me from time to time, so I'll just do it. Be careful of Delaware. That is, they do have a state tax in Delaware. But Alaska, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Texas, Washington, Wyoming, they're going to be your primary states to think about, and we can help you find that right state tax level. All right, welcome. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for being here. We love you. We'll be back next week with a topic to rock your world. We hope that you continue to listen. Please share the show with your friends and family, and we'll just keep living the dream with you.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing
strategies
to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.